On page 73, by the way, is one of the places where I think a lot of people had a lot of confusion, and I know I did when I first came in. It says, on 73, it says, told someone else all their life story. So, not to get too off the subject, but I know that OA in Chicago has gone through a lot of changes, because we used to literally write autobiographies and prenatal inventories. My mother had no clue she was even pregnant. What am I supposed to write down on here? But if you really looked at my resentment inventory, and you looked at all the people, places, and things that I was resentful at, and you looked at my fear inventory, and you looked at my sexual inventory, you would know everything about me. I didn't really have anything to write in my sexual inventory when I did my first 4-step, because I had never even been on a date. And so what my sponsor did was he just took out the word sex, and I took each relationship in my life and I subjected it to the same type of inventory that you would do with a sexual inventory. In other words, why was I friends with this person? Or in my relationship with this person that I was very close with, where was I selfish? What should I have done better? Things like that. So I didn't have a sexual inventory. I had never harmed anybody in that area or contacted anybody in that area. So I did it with all the relationships in my life. So if you really saw that, you would know my life story. And I've said this before, and I'll probably say it again before I start crying at the end, and that is, you know me better than anybody does. I may not have known you before. Some of you I speak to regularly. Some of you some of you I've never met before. You know me better than anybody. You know right where I live. I have friends, and I'm very lucky, I have friends that I've been friends with for 50 years. They still to this day cannot understand why I cannot have a piece of cake. They just don't get it. Why do you still go to those meetings? You're still doing that? And when they found out I was coming here, why are you going there? You were just there. Why are you doing this? They, no clue. No clue. But you know where I live, and you know what makes me tick. Right in here. Right in the heart. Right in the soul. You know all these various things. Okay. After I've done my 5th step, I'm going to have to do, or want to do, 6 and 7. And they're very short in the big book. They're the shortest steps, but they get a lot of attention in another publication. But it says here, if we can answer to our satisfaction, when we look at step 6, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. When ready, we say something like this: My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have completed step 7. Now we need more action. It doesn't say more thought, it says more action. More action. Without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol or food, in our case. This is another reference to step 0. Remember back on page 58, it says, if you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. This is a reference to that. It's a reference to step 0. Probably there are some misgivings as we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. We may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end of itself. The real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. There's that expression that was an Oxford group expression, maximum service to God. And this is something I talked about before, and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to be branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. But our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. So what this book is telling me is I can't just go into a person that I owe money to and say, gee, I'm really sorry I owe you money. They're going to say, I'm sorry too, where's my money? What they're telling me is I must demonstrate through action that I have contrition. Some of the purpose of the steps is to make me right with God, to make me right with myself and right with my fellow human being. The action of the inventory is to uncover, discover, and discard. I can't uncover, discover, and discard without the discard. And the way to discard is to make right these wrongs. The way to discard is to rid myself of these things. Some of that in the fourth step that we talked about is done through prayer. But in order for me to alleviate the fear, going back to the example I used before, I fear Steve. And the reason is I owe Steve $25,000. Well, if I pay Steve the $25,000, I'm probably not going to fear him anymore. So I am getting myself right with God, right with myself, and right with my fellow human being by paying Steve back the $25,000. It's that simple, and yet it's that, you know, we have to take that action. It's more a willingness and a faith to move forward and take that action. Very, very important. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God when it will serve any good purpose. We are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be that he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend. We find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill will, ill feeling, and expressing our regret. Under no circumstance do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. We never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the results. In other words, I don't walk into Steve's office and say, here's your $25,000, you skinflint. I walk in, and I have a good attitude, and I say, Steve, I'm really sorry that I owe you this money. And maybe I can't pay it back all at once, but here's $5,000 or here's $200 or whatever that is. I'm demonstrating my goodwill. More than that, I cannot do. I don't avoid paying him back out of fear. Remember that I have God with me at this point. I'm not going to avoid paying him or seeing him because of fear. I'm going to go to him in a calm and forgiving manner. Okay. our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing, in nine cases out of ten, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. Most alcoholics owe money. That's the understatement. We do not dodge our creditors, telling them what we are trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our compulsive eating or alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Now, for me, most of my amends were money amends. I didn't really kiss anybody's wife. I didn't really do anything like that. My amends were really money amends. And what I had to do was I had to take the bit in my teeth and I had to go to these people that I had written bad checks to, and I had to go to these people and apologize to those people for what I had done, and I had to pay them back. What I found was, to a person, every one of them received me very well. On a couple of occasions, the people tore up my debt and said, "We're even. I just wanted you to come in and talk to me." And this was thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, the government I owed money to because I didn't pay my taxes. So here's what happened in my life. When I put my hand in God's, I was able to make these amends, and I was able to do it with fear in my heart, yes, but I was able to do it and put them behind me. I was scared. I was scared because I was thinking, well, my God, I'm just starting to make some money now. How am I ever going to do this and pay all my bills and all this other stuff? And one day at a time, one week at a time, one month at a time, one person at a time, I was able to do it. And what happened was, is that little by little, little by little, these wrongs that I had done were getting cleared up. And it was just absolutely euphoria. It was such a feeling of exhilaration. When I first did my eighth step, my sponsor let me do four lists. One list, I'll make amends right away. Two, I'll do later. Three, I'll do much later. And four, I'll do when hell freezes over. And he knew that what I didn't know was that eventually it felt so good that I would really race through them and I would want to do them, because it was the Emancipation Proclamation. And what's very, very important for me to remember is that if I'm smart enough to steal the money, I'm smart enough to pay it back. Now, what was also difficult for me too was there were a couple of money amends that amounted to a couple of $1,000, nothing real serious, that got by me. You know, I'm not perfect. I forgot this one, I forgot that one. And at that time, it was not my money anymore. I was married at that time, newly married at that time with a baby, and I had to go to my wife, because now it wasn't my money anymore, it was our money. And I had to go to my wife and explain to her what was going on, and she was fine with it. She just said, "You just go ahead and do it," because my wife is very black belt Al-Anon, and she works her program, and she knows that these are the things that we need to do, and if we don't do them, I'm going to eat, and if I eat, we have no family. And so that was very important, that I had that kind of faith to go to her and to do it and not just sweep it under the rug. Because the easier thing to do was to say, "I'm not going to confront my wife and this other person, I'm just going to let it go." And I couldn't do that, because I knew if I did, I would eat. And if I ate, I was going to die. And another thing that's very, very important for me to remember is this. Dr. Bob met Bill on May 11th, 1935. May 11th, 1935 was Mother's Day. That was when they met in the Cyberling Gatehouse and the Cyberling Estate in Akron, Ohio. We count the birthday of AA as June the 10th, 1935. Because what happened was, between May 11th and June the 8th or 7th, Bob was sober. And then a couple of days before the 10th, he went to a medical convention, and Ann Smith begged Bill not to let him go. And Bill said, he's got to go, because he's going to live in a world where there's liquor, and he's either going to drink it or he's not. I can't just wet nurse him the whole time. And Bob went to the convention, and he was drunk before the train pulled out of the station. And he stayed drunk in Atlantic City, and he came back to Akron, and he ended up in the house of his nurse. And his nurse called Ann Smith and said, Ann, you better come and get him. He's soused. So Ann went over there and got him, and he was plastered. He comes in, and Dr. Bob was a proctologist. And he was the only one on staff at Akron General that could do a certain surgery the next day, was the 10th. And he says to Bill, they sobered him up, and on the morning of June the 10th, he says, I'm shaking. I can't do the surgery. And Bill Wilson did something for Dr. Bob that AA sponsees were hoping that their sponsors would do for them. He popped open a beer and gave it to him so that it would steady his hand so that he could do the surgery. And Bill Wilson waited for Dr. Bob in the parking lot of Akron Hospital for hours and hours and hours. Pretty soon, Bill goes back to the Smith house, and Ann is there, and the children are there, no Bob. So Bill assumes something like this, that the beer that he gave Bob triggered the allergy, and that Bob is back off to the races again. No, that was not the case. One of the Oxford Group tenets that we talked about before was restitution. And that's where our eighth and ninth step comes from. Bill knew that no good alcoholic was going to run around making restitution. So he changed it into what we have today as 8 and 9. And Bob had gone around Akron making restitution for the harms that he had done these people because of his alcoholism, which he thought no one knew. And the truth was that everyone knew. See, when you're morbidly obese, it's obviously out there. But in the case of the alcoholics, maybe it's not quite as obvious. Well, June the 10th, 1935, Bob never found it necessary to ever drink again as long as he lived until he died in 1950. And it was the amends-making process, or the restitution process, which finally emancipated him from his alcoholism. And so what we have to remember is, no matter what the consequences we fear, fear is false evidence appearing real. We take the bit in our teeth and we go to it, because there is no other way. Now, sometimes I'm faced with things like I'm faced with. I have to make amends to people that are dead. My mother and my father are gone. I had to make amends to them. I'd harmed them. During her life, I would have done anything I could have to hurt my mother. I blamed her for everything. I hated everything from my name to my surroundings to everything, and it was all her fault. What eventually happened, because I had to write them letters, which were torn up, and my sponsor took a look at the letters and he said, not an indictment, a letter. And he tore it up. And I had to keep writing letters until it was acceptable. And of course, you know, I don't, what am I going to do with them? Well, we read them and we burned them, which is not rectifiable in the big book, but that's what we did. How do I make amends to my mother? How do I make amends to my dad? Well, how I do it is this. I live my life according to these steps. I live my life according to this book and the instructions, because I believe that there is no greater gift that I could give them back than to live my life this way. There is no greater gift that I could give them. My dad and my mom and I had a very tumultuous relationship that changed over time. And what would happen over time is the first 10 years or so, I realized that my mom and dad were who they were, and I didn't choose them. I understood that I didn't choose them. And so, for a while, I accepted the fact that they were my parents, but I didn't choose them. Notice I used the word, but I didn't choose them. About 10 more years into recovery, it occurred to me, through a lot of work and self-sacrifice in this program, that they didn't choose their surroundings either. That my mother didn't choose her mental illness either. That my father didn't choose the nightmarish conditions and the unbelievably horrific situations which dumped him in America. He didn't choose the murder and the mayhem that he came from. He didn't choose the fact that he had no coping mechanism with which to live in this country. He did not choose it. But if they could have been Rob and Laura Petrie, they would have been Rob and Laura Petrie. That they would have denied me nothing. That they loved me. And all they wanted for me to be was happy. And all they wanted for me to be was a person living in recovery. They didn't know what recovery was, never did in their life. But now they can know that even though I gave this son of a bitch of an illness decades of my life, I don't have to give it one more minute. And that is a gift I give back to them. My daughter looks just like my dad. She speaks English and she doesn't smoke. But she looks exactly like my dad, and she is him to a T. Same sense of humor, same heart, same soul as my dad. She is him to a T. And when she was born, I carried her into the neonatal intensive care unit. She was very sick as a child. I carried her in there, and they were putting her in the isolette. They were putting her in the little thing that they do. And she was 10 minutes old, and she looked like a pumpkin, a little tiny pumpkin. And when she was born, they told us that there was a very good chance, that because she had been in such neonatal distress, there was a very good chance that she would have cerebral palsy and possibly be blind and deaf and possibly developmentally delayed. Okay. When she was born, they dried her off, and the nurse said, "It does not appear that baby is blind." And we walked her into the neonatal intensive care unit, and I started watching them stick my little baby with needles. And she was crying in there. And instantly I understood my mother and father's plight. Instantly I got it. That when they saw me crying, they were dying on the inside too. That when they saw me suffering, a little piece of them was dying every time. But it took my daughter Hannah to be born for me to get that. And instantly I looked up from the isolette as she was thrashing around, and they're sticking her with IVs and needles and chest monitors and everything. She was 5 pounds, 4 ounces. She went down to 3 pounds, 2 ounces almost instantly. And her heart stopped that night, and she stopped breathing that night, and now she's fine, trust me. She's okay. She can text, talk on the phone, do instant messaging all at the same time, that they've got the cameras going, and you got to come to the camera with your outfit, and I can't see the shoes, and the whole thing. So she's fine, but and she is the light of my life. I don't know what happened to my little baby. I don't. I was telling John and Harriet this at dinner. When she was 2-3 years old, she was lovey-dovey and kissy and huggy. You used to have to peel her off of me. Now it's, don't touch me! I hate you! And all, what happened to my little baby? When I was coming here on the airplane, I saw a family with a little tiny kid, maybe one. And I was thinking to myself, man, if I could just do it over again, but what are you going to do? You know, you live forward, you look backward. But the bottom line is, this is how I make amends. And how I make amends is to work the program and do the right thing in my life. And to honor them by loving my daughter enough to let her be a kid and not say to her, I hate your mother, the only reason I live here is because of you. Or to not pass on that torture, to not pass on that pain that they passed on to me, even though they didn't know. They didn't know any better. They didn't know any better. Okay, it's no wonder that the so-called promises come in after step 9. Very, very important to note that this is what... Is it freezing in here or is it me? I am like a popsicle in here, my God in heaven. I tried not to say anything, but yikes, my teeth are knocking together over here. And I'm cursing myself for not bringing a sweatshirt. Yikes! Okay. Let's go to page 83, if we would, please. I'm starting to bore some of you, I can tell. Okay. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. I just talked about them. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. If we are, here's the so-called promises, but before I read them, I want to go to the bedevilments on page 52 very quickly to show you what happens, because you see the promises if you do the program, what happens if you don't. Page 52. Quickly, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems to the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. You betcha. We couldn't control our emotional natures. True. We were a prey to misery and depression. Absolutely. We couldn't make a living, for sure. We had a feeling of uselessness and were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. My way doesn't work. And as I've said several times since I got here today, I have to be out of ideas on how I'm going to do this myself. I have to be out of ideas on how I'm going to work the program Harlan's way. And I have to do it the big book way. This is the program, not me. Okay. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, We will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
Yeah.
I think not. Right. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow, not stay the same, but to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Where did we deal with those things? In step 4. And remember this. No matter how evolved my recovery, I'm never going to rise above the level of human being. And that's why the 10th step and the 11th step and the 12th step are not steps to help me stay where I'm at. They are steps to move me forward. Because as I go through life, there are going to be things that are going to make me angry, that are going to scare me, that are going to threaten my security, my social, my sex instinct. There are going to be things. Heck, you guys live in Southern California. Just go out on the highway. If you're in Fitzgerald, just go out on the darn highway and you'll get challenges right there. You'll get challenged right there. And this is the thing that we have to remember is I have to do this every single day. I don't just do a 10 step here and there. I don't just do a 10 step like I change my oil every 3 months or every 5,000 miles. I have to do this every day. If I don't, it builds and builds and builds and builds, and the next thing you know, I'm eating. The next thing you know, I'm not in fit spiritual condition and I'm eating. Okay. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. It's very important for me to get out of myself. Very, very important for me to think of someone else. And when we read through Bill's story, we saw how the spiritual awakening in Bill's life transformed him into a person that was thinking of others. That is not who I am. I am by my nature a selfish, manipulative, lying taker. I am not a giver. But because of the work that I've done in this program, I have a sense that I want to be, not need to be, but want to be helpful of the striving. Loving and kind toward the weak, the wrong, and the unknowing. And I have a sense in my life I will be all of those things. I have to get off my high horse. As we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience as long as we react. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol, food is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities, not some, but all. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. There's your 10th step prayer. There's prayer in 10 right there. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, not suggestions, directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. Not thought, action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than us are using it constantly. This is the page I live in every day of my life. I follow these instructions every single day of my life. God is constantly with me because I invite Him into my life. And what I had to learn from doing this over and over again is this. And this was something that is very foreign to me. I spent my whole life shouting at God about how big my problems are. And I am learning one day at a time to tell my problems how big my God is. That when things happen, I have to understand that God is bigger than these things and that I am mortal and all I can see is what is in front of me. I can see this, but I can't see the bigger picture. Any fool can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. I have to understand that there's a gestation period for many of God's miracles in the world. That there is that gestation period that I am going to have to wait. And when it's over, I'm going to see solutions that I never even dreamed possible. So I'm going to go through these instructions here, and then I'm going to do step 12 as quickly as I can, do a little closing, and then whatever we, before I like fall over here. Okay. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Here's your step 4 stuff again, okay? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. This is very important for me to do every single day. The big book tells me how to live my life. The big book will tell me everything and anything I want to know. It tells me what to do at night. Now it's going to tell me what to do in the morning. an awakening. Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers will come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch and the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is now probable we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption with all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask specifically for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may request for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. What the big book is instructing me to do over and over and over again is get out of myself and continue the work. Get out of myself and continue to work. The work. This brings us to step 12, and I'm going to go through this as quickly as I can. And what I want to remind myself of every day is that I am a message. I am a message. I've told you that I have a daughter who is going to be 14 years old on December 20th. December 20th is my wedding anniversary. December 14th is my little girl's birthday, and she's going to be 14. But I have 9.5 years of abstinence. And when we were living in Eugene at the time. We were living in Oregon at the time. It was a very hot summer day, especially for Eugene. And it was a Sunday morning. My daughter was not quite 2. And she was running around in her little diaper. And I had to realize something at the end of this, that I am a message, whether I want to carry one or not. But my daughter was not quite 2. And my wife had come in on a Sunday, and she had just bought the grocery store. I mean, everything. She was putting things in bags and weighing and measuring. And I mean, she had just done a major, major grocery shop. And she was doing what she does, you know, bagging and putting away and all this other stuff. And my little angel of a daughter, my little angel child, lifted up her little hand. And you know how they had, she was just at the end part with the rolls and everything, you know, she was just like in that little pudgy phase, she was just coming out of it. And she grabbed the handle of the refrigerator, and she turned around just like this, and she said to my wife, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." I wonder where she got that. If looks could kill, I would have been vaporized on the spot. I was carrying a message to that little girl. I was demonstrating to that little baby, that little sweetie pie, that I would no more hurt than I would anything. I love her so much. But I was demonstrating the illness to my child. Because whether I want to be carrying a message or not, I am carrying a message. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, if I have not worked the steps, I cannot have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And it doesn't say having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. It says the result of these steps. The spiritual awakening is the result of the steps. All of them. Without the food. We tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters. And that's what's very important. And I alluded to this before. And I'm going to talk about this again. You can't get this by absorbing spiritual information. You get to keep this by transmitting spiritual information. Pass it on. Pass it to the person. Pass it to the still sick, suffering, compulsive overeater, provided that they want it. If they don't want it, there's nothing you can do. If you don't have it, there's nothing you're going to pass them except what I pass to my daughter. There is a price to pay. Your seat here tonight does not come cheap. When Ebby went to see Bill, a flame was struck. A fragile flame that was struck in the middle of an Illinois tornado. Even though it was in New York City. And that tornado almost extinguished that flame. Ebby brought the flame to Bill. Bill brought the flame to Bob. But Ebby and Bill and Bob are gone. The first 100 AAs are gone. All those men and women who corroborated on the book and on the early fledgling society of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're not with us anymore. They've got a job for me, and they've got a job for you. And one day, that message came out here to California. And a man by the name of Jim Willis, founded, he was an alcoholic, and he founded an organization called Gamblers Anonymous. And there was a TV show that was talking about Gamblers Anonymous that was seen by Roseanne S. and her late husband Marvin. And they took a friend of Marvin's to the meeting of Gamblers Anonymous. And they approached Jim W. after the meeting when Roseanne heard her story being told by these gamblers, and she said something to Jim that changed the world. She said to Jim, "Do you think a program like this could help someone like me with food?" And he said, "You know, Roseanne, I don't see why not." You owe. You owe Roseanne. You owe the first few people that came in. Maxine R., A.G. Ainsworth, Norma B., you owe. And every time you go to a meeting, I hope that you'll pass on something that I got from A.G. Ainsworth. He said to me, "Every time you go to a meeting, tell these people how long you've been abstinent and how much weight you've lost. Otherwise, how in the hell are they ever going to know that this works?" You owe A.G., Norma B., Maxine, and all the people who went before you. Some of them are dead, and some of them are still living. But you can be helpful where others cannot be, because you know what it's like to live in hell. You know what it's like to be scared to death. And you know what it's like to be written off by the world that you were born into, often by the people closest to you who couldn't understand how you could be so stupid as to eat that way. Don't you know you're fat? Don't you know you're ugly? Don't you know this? Don't you know that? Yeah, you knew it. And all you knew how to do at that point was eat more, because that was the only way you could know, you could think of, to kill the pain that was inside of you. And maybe this time it wouldn't hurt quite so much. Maybe this time tomorrow you could control it. Maybe this time you'll eat, but tomorrow you'll get back on your diet and be good as opposed to bad. You know what that's like. Maybe you can't do much. But here's what you can do. You can love. You can welcome. You can greet. You can pull a chair for somebody. You can say hi. You can shake their hand. Maybe you're sitting here feeling, I have nothing to give. I could give them you. Dr. Bob said it boils down to love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. Now some of you in this room are new, and some of you in this room are not so new. But all of you in this room came here because the whip of this illness drove you here when you had nowhere else to go. When the pay and the ways had taken all your money, and they stapled your ear, and you wiggled your ear, and you stood on your head, and all those various things that you tried to control this failed, you came in here. You know what Dutch doors are? Dutch doors. They open and close the top and bottom independently of one another. My wife says they should nail the top shut, because if you don't crawl in, you will not stay. We are the last house on the block. And there are people out there that are scared to death. And they were beaten up too. And maybe they were raped too. And maybe their sisters died at an early age too. Or maybe they had a car accident like you did too. Or maybe you feel some pain that is akin to the pain that they feel, so that they can go home from their first meeting and know that there's a place I can go, and I met a woman or I met a man and they understood. Because you're not trying to sell them something. You're not trying to separate them from their money. Dr. Silkworth says that the message must have depth and weight. Ebby didn't ask Bill for money. Bill didn't ask Bob for money. They didn't ask Bill Dotson for money, Alcoholics number 3. They came and they gave of themselves with no expectation of a return. And they spoke the language of the heart. They spoke the language of the soul that only we speak. There are promises in step 12 as well. But just remember this before I show you where they are, to the world that you were born into, you are a person. To that person who is out there scared to death, you could be the world. You can light them up. You can save their lives. It says in the Old Testament, save one life, you save the world. You can live forever. Because what you'll do will never die. As one passes to the other, to the other, to the other, you will become immortal. There are some promises in step 12. Where am I? Oh. Page 100. Here's the 12-step promises very quickly. Page 100. First full paragraph. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. These are the promises of step 12. And the last part of step 12 is to practice these principles in all of our affairs. That's why there's a chapter to the family afterwards, to the employer, to wives, things like that. These steps are easiest for me to practice when I'm in OA. I'm in OA 5-6 hours a week. I go to 5-6 meetings a week. I'm in there for an hour. I love you. Maybe you love me. And it's easiest to practice these principles. The principles are the steps. He just didn't want to keep using the same word. The steps and the principles are the same thing. It's easiest for me to practice the steps in OA. It's harder to practice these principles or these steps in the workplace. That's why there's a chapter to employers. And if I can buy myself 8 hours a day or whatever that is a day of peace and serenity in the workplace, by bringing these steps with me into the workplace, there's another 40 hours a week or whatever. If I don't practice these steps in all of my affairs, I will find myself being more courteous and more friendly and more loving to the person in the grocery store than I will with my own wife and my own child in my own home. The hardest place for me to practice these steps is in my home. Familiarity often breeds contempt. So I need to keep that handle on my actions. Am I working my steps? Am I inventorying my resentments? Am I inventorying my sexual harms to others, my fears? Because if I'm not, my house will degenerate into the same battleground that I grew up in, and I will permanently affect my child, and I don't want to permanently do that, or my wife, or the dogs. We have two full-blooded champion line German shepherds and a Pomeranian. Never seen anything so funny in your life as a 6-pound Pomeranian bossing around a 110-pound German shepherd. It's something you shouldn't miss. To practice these principles in all of our affairs is just beautiful. To bring God with me wherever it is that I go. Let's very quickly turn to page 164. And before I close for the final thing, I just want to say to all of the people involved in this how much I appreciate your efforts. Mary, where are you? I can't see you. Where's Mary? Mary. Okay, breaking down stuff outside. Okay. Well, I can't really get her from outside, but I do appreciate John for picking me up, and John's going to take me back to my hotel room, and I'm going to catch a shuttle in the morning and go home. But I want to appreciate all of you for being here. What an unbelievable experience it was for me to be here with you today. And I want to thank all of you for having me. Let's close it up on page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. That's what we do in steps 1, 2, and 3. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows, 4, 5, 6, 7. Clear away the wreckage of your past, 8 and 9. Give freely of what you find and join us, 10, 11, and 12. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you so much for having me.